The man who at 11 o'clock every Sunday morning is on his soapbox at Hyde Park Corner. One of the last of a breed, the very last of a breed that I remember seeing.
What do you mean, last? I've got a whole gang of kids I'm training.
You're one of the last of the breed. How many?
Oh, yeah, well, you come along there any Sunday you like, and I'll put three or four kids up who are nearly as good as me.
All right, but they haven't got your background. They never suffered. They were brought up in the welfare state in Britain. They're soft. They're not like you, Harry Young, and you know that.
Oh, well, I don't know about being soft. I can't go for their personal background. But all I know is that they agree with my point of view.
That's different, Harry. Harry Young, the world-famous socialist, the true socialist, as he will tell you. Not milk-and-water Labour Party, not twisted Chinese Maoist, not soft-defeat Russian communist, but a true socialist. Is that you, Harry Young?
Well, I would say just socialist without true, because there aren't any untrue ones.
Yes, there are.
All right, then.
We had them in power in British Columbia here, untrue socialists.
Oh, don't you... Look, Jack Webster, we were doing this sort of thing when you were chasing bloody Indians, mate. We had a Labour government in 1924. You know about
I was brought up in Glasgow. I used to listen to you and the likes of you on Sunday nights in Exchange Square on the back of a coal cart preaching the true revolution. And you're right out of my boyhood. That's what you are.
Well, in those days, I was a brainwashed communist.
You and Jimmy Maxton and Willie Gallagher.
Willie Gallagher? Who's that there, look? There's Willie Gallagher. And there's me. Willie Gallagher, right in the middle.
The Communist Party, when was that?
First Central Committee of the Communist Party, 1920.
1920.
Right.
Okay, I was going to talk to some other people, but you've taken over the show, so I've got to make a commercial.
No, I don't want to do that. I'm a Democrat. I'll stand down.
Can a socialist be a Democrat?
A socialist can't be anything but a Democrat. Because, now, look, Jack, can I ask you, I'm going to interview you.
No.
Right?
After these commercial messages to help bolster the capitalist system.
What, capitalist commercials?
At 685-9181.
I'm not going to argue with him, am I?
No, this meeting will come to order.
Yeah.
Harry Young. Just a minute, Harry. Harry Young is here to speak for the Socialist Party of Canada. Harry Young is one of the last men alive on our side of the fence who was present at Lenin's last public appearance. He was also in close contact with Stalin, Trotsky, Bukharin, and Zinoviev, who was the leaders of the 1917 revolution in Russia of those days. He used to travel about on a false passport. And he spent 6 years in the Soviet Union, and why didn't somebody shoot you, Harry Young?
Well, I'm the one that got away. I decided to come back tonight. In 1929, I came back to England, bringing with me my Russian wife, whom I had a great deal of difficulty in getting out.
Even in those days?
I married a Russian girl in Moscow in 1923, cost me 3 rubles and took 3 minutes.
The ceremony did?
Yes.
It was a good investment.
Oh, well, it lasted a few years, but in 1935, I saw her after some time in the Haymarket. You know where that is.
I know the Haymarket well.
And you know what she did?
No.
She spat in my face, and she said, "I don't speak to disgusting Trotskyite renegades." Turned on her heel, and I've never seen her since. And when they came to interview me from the Sunday Times, the reporter said, "Would you mind telling me, she's still living she's living a stone's throw from the school where I used to teach."
You're 75 years of age.
And they said, "Can we have her address?" I said, "No, you cannot. She's an old lady over 70, just pestering her."
You had a feeling of sentiment for her, even though she spat in your face because you had defected from the true communism.
Right.
She was a communist.
Well, I couldn't say about now. I mean, who is now? The whole thing is pretty well non-existent now.
Harry, take one step back, because I feel an affinity to you, because you suffered in those days, being working-class English, born in East End.
Oh, wait a minute. When I was in Moscow, we weren't suffering. We lived on black bread, and we only had a plate of stew. You know what that is? That's cabbage water. We were lucky when I was in the Kremlin Congress at the Fall Congress in 1922, Jack Murphy, leader of the Engineers Union.
Right.
They gave out the money. It was a big sheet like that, little tiny stamps. And each one was 1 million rubles. And Jack Murphy said to me, they brought some little cakes in. They were 3 million each. And the girl at the cash desk has scissors. And she cut three stamps off, and that was my 3 million gone. My cake for a week. But what I'm going to tell you is this. All right, we suffered. We had nothing to eat, and it was cold. And, well, we lived in the Lux Hotel, so I think we were privileged. But we lived in a state of hysterical euphoria. We were the golden boys. We were conquering the world. There was Jacques Dariot, who became the mayor of the biggest suburb of Paris at 23, leader of the French Metal Workers Union, became the leader of the French Black Shirts in 1939, supporting Hitler. Got shot by the British. Ho Chi Minh? Ho Chi Minh. When I knew Ho Chi Minh, he was called Nguyen Ali Quack, and he'd been a dishwasher in Paris. And when he used to get up to speak, we couldn't understand a word of what he said. I didn't know much French anyway. And what the kind of French he spoke was more like Chinese. We all used to walk out when he got up.
Did you not finish up with a great admiration for Ho Chi Minh?
I didn't even know what... We didn't regard him as of any importance then.
But he finished up?
I lived next door to Big Bill Haywood of the IWW. In the Nooks Hotel. George Dimitrov in the Reichstag fire.
George Dimitrov, who was shot by the Nazis after he was blamed for setting the Reichstag fire.
Well, he got back again afterwards, but he was very lucky to get away.
He wasn't shot. No. They sentenced him to life.
Right.
Listen, you knew them all. How close were you?
Well, now look, I was a member of the executive committee of the Communist International, right? I was there when they expelled Trotsky, and one of the Russians there had a big Russian Communist Party delegation, chucked a telephone directory at Trotsky. Didn't hit him, missed him.
Lenin.
Hey?
Lenin. What about Lenin?
Well, look, in his personality, I'm not, what do you call, can I say this on the air? BS?
No, BS is okay. You're not BSing.
I'm not BSing. I've got no point in that. I mean, let the facts speak for themselves. I want to tell you what I think now, but I will tell you about Lenin. About your size. And if you had your head shaved off and a little red whiskers.
I'd look like him.
Well, a bit Mongolian, high cheekbones and a bit, you know, Chinesey eyes. But in his personality, a modest and retiring man. Do you believe that? I was in the vast hall of the Kremlin Palace. And Lenin was sitting down on the steps leading up to the big platform, scribbling his notes down. And Lenin came to the 1922 Congress with a sad story. He had to come and tell them that it wouldn't work any longer. That's what he was really saying. He said, we can't go on taking the peasants' coal anymore and giving them nothing in return. You know, bits of paper. We promised to pay 1 million rubles, a postage stamp. I brought you a little present.
Good, did you bring me one?
I brought you a 1,000-ruble note.
Listen, tell me more,
and it's got Workers of the World Unite on it.
I want you to continue with this theme, though, of Lenin, because therein lies the whole change in Russian communism. Is that not right?
Yes, you could say that. I would say that Lenin, as far as I understood him, was absolutely honest and sincere. He hoped that he could swing the others. You see, in 1914, when he got the telegram to say that the German Social Democrats...
Right.
...had voted for the war, he refused to believe it. He said, it's a frame-up, I won't believe it. And he had a nervous breakdown, and his wife, that Krupskaya, who was a school teacher in Petersburg, took him on a month's walking tour of the Alps in Switzerland to get him over it.
Wouldn't believe. He was then living in Switzerland.
Oh, they were all in Switzerland in exile. Zinoviev was there. Fatty Zinoviev, I never liked him. Our favourite was Bukharin. He was terrific.
I know we're getting off the point, but who was it that organized the secret guarded railway train that took Lenin back through Germany into Russia?
Well, the German high command, but the man who was most instrumental in it was a man called Gustav Platen, who was a leader of the Swiss Social Democratic Party.
That was clever.
He started the negotiation. Yeah, but then Lenin came and he started the insurrection in July, which was shot down by Kerensky and the Cossacks. He ran away to Finland because he'd have been assassinated if he didn't. Came back again and staged the next one. And by this time, Kerensky, the silly fool, had given the Russian workers the rifles because a bloke named Kornilov was marching on Petersburg. And he armed all the population to keep this other one out. And the result was that once Lenin had control of these Soviets, you know what Soviets were? Councils. Well, in the councils, there was all also delegates from the Army and the Navy. The bloody Red Navy sailed a cruiser up the river and trained the guns on the Winter Palace and gave him 24 hours to get out.
Yeah.
So that once they had that, Trotsky was elected president of the Petersburg or Petrograd Soviet. Trotsky, the most superb orator I've ever heard in my life. That bloody man, I've spoken to 10,000 recruits of the Red Army on the Red Square. And Trotsky, he could get them cheering and waving their rifles in about 5 minutes.
Listen, you're a man of history. Fascinating.
Oh, I don't like being told this. The Socialist Party of Canada said, you must come over, you're a living legend. And I wrote and I said, I'm not going to be a living legend. And they wrote back and said, it's better than being a dead one.
6859181. It's because, as I say, you're a living legend, you don't want to be a dead legend. Here's a guy who was a... What was your position in the Communist International?
Well, I was the representative of the Communist Youth Movement. I suppose, in a way, that's why I'm still here, because I was only a kid when I started it. You see, but I went to Moscow, and I don't think it was any... Well, I'm bloody sure it wasn't due to any special qualifications of mine. When I went there, I didn't know a word of Russian or German or French, which I had to learn. They gave me a good training, don't you worry about that. And, Jack, I'm going to recommend you something to you. They stopped me smoking. And I've never smoked since.
How did they stop
you? Well, we were dedicated revolutionaries. We were dedicated, professional, utterly, almost you might say, religious revolutionaries. This was the tradition of the old Bolshevik Party and in the underground with the Black Hand, the Tsar's secret police. You couldn't... The old Leninist professional revolutionary, he was like a rat in a sewer.
Don't forget now, you're talking about an age when the average Canadian from 50 under... And I say this maybe alienating many people, knows next to nothing about this key part in world history. Had Lenin lived, would it have been different in the Soviet Union? Would it have been a socialist democracy?
No, it would not. It was quite impossible. And Lenin himself, I heard from his own lips, although I didn't understand German very well, and he spoke it even worse, with a very thick Russian accent. And no, there's nothing that Lenin could have done, because I don't subscribe to the great man theory. I am a 100% dyed-in-the-wall, true-blue Marxist. That is the... All right, the old-fashioned Marxist. Okay, I don't care. And the Marxian theory says that no great man can change history if the conditions for the change are not there. And Lenin tried to jump the gun. He tried to force it over the heads of 150 illiterate peasants, and it couldn't be done.
Wasn't there a chance, though, that there could have been a coalition of the Mensheviki, or whatever you called them,
yep,
at Russia in 1917, 1918?
Yes, that's right. And if Lenin hadn't have arrived, if they still had kept him in Switzerland, he'd have probably gone raving mad with frustration, because he was the man who came back and said, no, we're having none of this. All power to these Soviets. Well, he was really clever in this. He was a astute, brilliant genius of a political opportunist. He saw that anybody who had these Soviets had got the army and the navy, and one who's got the army and the navy can give the orders.
And that was the reason they won the war.
Well, now, give Lenin credit. Out of all the politicians of those days, he was the only one who kept his word. He promised the Russian people he'd stop the war, and he did. Incidentally, neither he nor anybody else could have made them go on with the war, because they couldn't. They were starving. The bloody soldiers at the front in the cold had no boots and no bullets for their... as he said, they voted with their feet. The Russian muzhik, the peasant, he got up and he went home. And so that Kerensky said, go on with the war, and they said, you know...
Go jump in the lane.
Yeah, yeah.
6859181. A former associate of Lenin, a friend of Trotsky's. Close enough, eh?
Well, hardly. An acquaintance.
An acquaintance.
Friend of Bukharin.
Who put the ice pick in his head? Who are the...
A fellow called Jack Mercader, who was an American communist, Russian agent of the KGB.
Ordered so to do by Stalin?
Of course. And the reason he used an ice pick was because the shot would have aroused all the guards.
Looking around the world today, is there any government you, as a socialist, and my listeners know what I mean when I say socialist, I don't mean a communist, I don't mean a social democrat, I mean a socialist, that you would approve of or come near to approve?
No, not one. No socialist can approve of any government, because government, by its very dictionary definition, presupposes classes. A government orders people about, and a government must have governed to rule. You must have governors, a governing class. Now, socialism will abolish classes or it will be nothing.
Is this what we call the dictatorship of the proletariat?
No. Now, about this, I'm not giving a history talk in Vancouver College, which I'm going to do on Thursday anyway, so I'm not going to impose that on.
Right.
But let me say this very quickly to help the listeners. This term has, but there's been more misrepresentation, abuse of this term. When Karl Marx used it in 1850, it was merely a popular slogan from the 1848 revolution. And the idea of it then was the taking of power by the majority. Now, when poor old Lenin arrived at the Finland station in 1917, his problem was 150 million peasants who were not socialists, never heard of socialism, didn't want socialism, and want another bigger bit of land. That's what they wanted. So, more or less, I think, like a Canadian farmer, right? And so, Lenin, now, very cleverly, he bent the rules. He said, now, what this means, and he used the name of Marx with its enormous prestige, as it is today, everybody who hijacks a plane or goes and smashes the windows in Grosvenor Square at the American Embassy calls himself a Marxist. The bloody liars. These stupid little hotheads, they make me sick. I've told them to stop screaming and start thinking and reading.
Hold your breath, and forgive the bloodies. It's natural for Harry. Next day, 11 o'clock news. This program, because it is a program, and I'm telling you right now, if you're interested in political history in Europe, you got to hear Harry Young. Harry Young, he's not a Neanderthal. He's a convinced man of a very special, and I'll say it to his face, dying breed. He's speaking tomorrow at the University of Victoria, 12:30. He's speaking to Esquimalt High School, and Grace McCarthy will flip her gasket the next day. And then at Vancouver Community College on the 4th, which is what day, Thursday? What date's for the 4th? Quick. You sure? The 4th at 12:30. Now, he intrigues me very much indeed. The Socialist Party of Great Britain. It's not the Labour Party. You despise the Labour Party, don't you?
Can I speak Canadian?
Yes.
I've learnt some. They make me throw up.
All right. It's not the Communist Party because...
Oh, no, that's worse. Oh, for Christ's sake, don't. No, I'll run away.
You despise the Communist apparatus.
Absolutely.
What do you think of trade unions in our world? That's United States, Canada, and Great Britain.
Well, now, look, it would be most presumptuous of me to try and give some detailed analysis of Canadian or American trade unions, although, of course, I'm not, obviously, speaking as much as I do, we've got as many Americans in Hyde Park as there are in New York these days, and I went down to Bucknell University. By the way, it's one of the reasons I'm here. They gave me a marvellous time.
Capitalist time.
A capitalist plutocratic university. Reeking of wealth, the most opulent, except for the Kremlin in Moscow, the most opulent auditorium I've ever spoken in. But they gave me a marvellous time and they invited me there, and I was talking to them on the same topic. I know they've told me because they had Jimmy Hoffa in the Lewisburg Penitentiary there, and the head of the and the head of the political science there said he used to go and visit Jimmy Hoffa every week. So he said there's only two things in Lewisburg: the penitentiary and the college. I said, well, where is the food the best? He said, the college. I said, right, I'm coming there, and that's where I went.
Now let me tell you about trade unions. Yeah, the position
now,
of the trade union.
Trade unions will disappear under socialism. This nonsense that the communists have peddled, and the idea that you can bring socialism nearer by strikes or riots or upheavals or shouting or breaking windows, is nonsense. Socialism will only come by education. Socialism, and Marx was not a terrorist, he was an anti-terrorist and a convinced democrat. He wrote in so many words explicitly that the form for the transformation of society had been found. It was the form of the democratic republic as evolved in France and subsequently in the United States, and I think I may say Canada. Now, all the business about trade union leaders being corrupt and all that, well, I mean, you're living in a corrupt society, and a rat race breeds fat rats, and that's what we've got. We've got those in England as well, but they're much cleverer than you are. Jack Jones is much cleverer than Jimmy Hoffa. He doesn't allow himself to be involved in any open sort of schemes and...
But he's a fat rat.
No, he's a very nice fellow. I know him personally, but immediately the trade unions, through the General Council of the Trade Union Congress, you know, the papers every day in Britain now say that the real Prime Minister of Great Britain is Jack Jones, and not Callaghan at all, because Callaghan has to go and see, or ask Jack Jones to come and see him to see what can go on. But so long, immediately trade unions start dabbling in what is not their business, start dabbling in politics and running political intrigues, then, of course, the trade unions have abandoned the only job which they can do and for which they were organised. The only thing that a trade union can do is increase the price of the commodity which a worker sells to his employer. And when I get this bloke Johnny Makins on the radio on the island shrieking about prices, I'm going to say to him, there's one price that you wouldn't mind going up, is there, Johnny? And if he says, what's that? I say, your salary, because that's a price too.
You know, you've just lost me a little bit. Surely in the United Kingdom, the Trade Union Congress deserves great credit for supplying the political clout and the organization which, against the odds of the shopkeeper mentality of Britain, elected a social democratic Labour Party government. Surely that was a step in the right direction.
No, I don't think so. And if I had anything to do with the Canadian working class, and if you ask me, I've got to answer, of course, although I don't want to dabble. And when I was accused in Winnipeg on the radio of coming here to stir up trouble, that's the last thing a socialist... A socialist doesn't stir, he spreads knowledge. He diffuses knowledge and tries to convince by education and by peaceable means. That's why sticks in my guts this stupid nonsense of the communists. Now let me say this about trade unions. What a trade union can do, the only thing it can do, is improve the conditions of its members by negotiation with employers. As soon as a trade union starts to do what it's done in Britain in the last 5 or 6 years, the last time we had 4.25% that the silly General Council agreed to, I may tell you that most of the rank and file are now shouting Len Murray out, and he'll go out. They'll all go the same way. They'll all go to the bloody House of Lords. It's full of them. George Brown, that pot-bellied twister, he's Lord Brown. Now, Lord, she'll be Lady Barbara Castle. We've actually got a member of our own party. Do you know this? We've got a member, you know, you've heard of Charlie Lester?
Yes, yes.
Lester's Corner. Lester's got two daughters in England, right? One stuck to our party through thick and thin, just like our old man. The other one, a member of the bloody cabinet, if you please. Assistant member of education. A minister.
A traitor to the working classes.
Well, that's what her sister calls her.
When you were in Hyde Park one day, a couple of men came up to you when you came off the podium and said, you got to come to Saskatoon because it's the only socialist government at that time in the Western Hemisphere. What happened when you got to Saskatoon?
They said, come and have a cup of tea. I went to Lyons's and had a cup of tea. And, you know, I hadn't got the heart. I said, have you been listening to what I've been saying up there? And they said, yes. And I hoped at that time that all Canadians were not as thick as that. Anyway, I got to Saskatoon, but it was on the Greyhound bus at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I soon discovered that there's no socialism there. There's capitalism there. I only had to look through the main street to see the tickets with the prices, and then I knew there was a monetary system. Now, if you've got a monetary system, Jack, I don't care how good it is, and you may claim that it's affluent and everybody is rolling in the lap of social security and doing well, it's still capitalism. It's still a rat race. It's not socialism. Socialism will abolish the monetary system, classes, governments, titles, and all the rest of it. It won't reduce everybody to a common level as they think here.
What's the phrase? From each according to his...
ability!
And to each according to his needs.
And you know what this bloody scoundrel Stalin...
Who said that?
Well, it was commonplace in France right throughout the 1940s and the 50s, and Marx simply picked it up. As a good political journalist, he used it. But what Stalin did when he came along, this bloody twister, with his Soviet constitution, he changed one word from each according to his ability to each according to his work. Is that socialism? It's bloody capitalism. It's piecework.
Oh, no, you've lost me, Harry.
Oh, no, I haven't. You know this better than I do.
From each according to his ability.
Now, look,
Now, look,
Jack, you know me on the platform. You don't get any soft soap from us. Nobody gets flannelled by us, but you're the best bloody man, you understand. More about it in 2 minutes than all the lot of them all over Canada.
Good for you, Harry. That's because of my working class upbringing on the south side of Glasgow. 685-9181. The Socialist Party of Great Britain. A lot of people would say they're just Neanderthals in the wilderness. Right, Harry? Is that not right? It's not often I get a chance to ask an old-timer like you, an acquaintance of Trotsky, a man who saw and heard Lenin and all the rest of the big shots, and Stalin. Did you ever meet him face to face?
Of course, yes. I could describe him closely. Stalin had a number of very funny personal habits. I sat in meetings round tables with him, you know, on various problems. When there were discussions, so on the Chinese problem, the British question, Stalin used to smoke a little, he's a Georgian, spoke a Russian with a very thick Caucasian accent, and had a very pockmarked face, very swarthy, very black.
What were his habits that you didn't like?
Well, I don't know about personal habits. I couldn't claim any personal acquaintance with him. But he had a peculiar habit at the meetings. He smoked a little tiny curved Georgian Caucasian pipe. And you know, you could buy the packets of cheap cigarettes there. That was the one thing that was always plentiful, even in the days of war communism, with the long tubes on. And the Russian papirossi. And he used to break the cardboard tube off and stuff the cigarettes, paper as well, down in this little pipe and puff away. And not very talkative in the committee meetings.
Now, Thursday at Vancouver Community College, you're going to give an outline of the history, but you've given us a little bit of an outline just now about the injection, unsuccessful at first injection of Lenin into the unsettled, losing Russian business. And then along came Kerensky and the others, and final, the Soviets and Lenin took over, correct?
Right.
That was the first step. Now, that was a failure, the Russian Revolution. You tell me now, despite the fact that they're on the moon in 50 years, they've got consumer goods beyond belief, they may have no freedom, but he is surely Russian communism has lifted the Russians up by the bootstraps and put them on a par in some ways, in steel production, for instance, with the United States.
Yes, I would agree, and the average Russian, who is by no means a Leninist, the average Russian would still, like most people, having a struggle to keep his nose above water in any country that you go into. The average Russian obviously still votes, as far as they're allowed to, vote communist. Although, don't overlook the fact that only one party is allowed. I mean, I heard Bukharin say, of course there are two parties in Russia. One is in power, the other one's in prison. And that's still the situation today. But so long as they can supply the average Russian with the limited amount that he gets by comparison with Canadian standards, for instance. I mean, don't overlook that, Jack. Be fair.
That's why you want the revolution.
No, wait a minute. All right, well, wait a minute. What you've got is the domination of the Communist Party, and that is absolutely, utterly sickening, because the Communist Party has ceased to have the slightest, remotest resemblance to the Communist Party that I knew, when it was really a collection of dedicated idealists. But in these days, the apparatchik of the Communist Party, with his Communist Party card, is the privileged member of society, and the red flag has taken the place of the icon, and Lenin in the glass case in the museum there has taken the place of the Greek Orthodox Pope.
Now, though, supposing conditions became right, and it's not unlikely that one of these years the capitalist system will crumble under various pressures, and so might well the communist system. Supposing you could wave the magic wand. This socialist Valhalla of yours depends on having nothing but people of total education in your method and people of gentility and goodwill. Is that not correct?
Absolutely right.
Can't be done.
Well, you may say that, but my view is that the human organism is the most social animal in the world, and that he acts very largely, reacts according to his environment that he finds himself in.
Wave your magic wand and describe your socialist.
No, Valhalla. I have no magic wand, but what I am firmly convinced about is the engine of social progress. I think that Marx was right when he wrote in the last volume, chapter of that book, Capital, that the very mechanism of the operation of the capitalist system itself increases the numbers and drills, organizes, and trains the working class to overthrow capitalism.
Now, that's a pat phrase we've all heard many a time. Drills and organizes the workers and increases the numbers to overthrow capitalism.
Okay.
Right? But who starts the movement for, as I keep saying, your socialist Valhalla, heaven and earth?
Well, the only people who are starting it are the people like me. We've got a little tiny group in Canada now. And by Christ, they must be facing odds of millions to one. And they still stick to it. Now, those kind of ideas are the only ones which will inspire people,
you know,
to
Harry,
confront those odds and do that work.
You kind of remind me of a man or a woman, I can't remember. Remember now, I used to hear in the Depression, it was a party, it was called, and maybe you can even remember it, the Christian Communist Party.
Oh, it may have been, but this has nothing to do with the Socialist Party. A Socialist Party is committed to what was called the materialist conception of history, which means that we can't accept the existence of any supernatural being or... You started off about the trade unions, and I amazed several people, I've no doubt, by saying that trade unions will abolish socialism, the same as capitalism abolished the horse and cart. You don't want... if there's no working class, there can't be trade unions. Now, I'm saying that society will evolve along socialist lines because all the motive driving forces of capitalism, in my view, are bound to produce that. Now, I know you're going to tell me people are greedy, they're selfish, they're lazy, they're aggressive, they're violent and brutal. They live in those conditions, and how the hell can you expect a rat race to breed anything but rats? But do you know, Jack, that in spite of all this, and we see it every day, there are 1,001 things that people can turn to. Any time there's any emergency, any time there's any disaster, do people demand money first before they rush to the assistance of their fellow man? Don't you know, haven't you got in Canada hundreds of voluntary organizations where people delight in doing things to help other people that they don't receive a penny piece for, or any material award, or even any recognition for that matter? And why do you think I should be doing this, running about Canada in a greyhound bus like a bloody nutcase, when I should be at home with my carpet slippers listening to old Jack Webster on the radio?
But what you're preaching is decency, tolerance, understanding and gentility without force.
And I think that the working class is capable of that because they already work together. They have to.
But they can't achieve that until they get rid of the capitalist class, whether it goes away by itself or whether it...
Well, now, it won't go away by itself and it won't collapse. It will only be abolished by a conscious, intelligent action by the majority of the workers. And if you, Jack, are going to adopt the mantle of Lenin and tell me what Lenin told John Reed, the American newspaper man who wrote that famous book... Lenin told John Reed, he said, if we have to wait for the workers to establish socialism, we'll have to wait 500 years. The workers can only evolve a trade union consciousness. Now, this is where I beg to differ with my great master and teacher, Nikolai Lenin, Vladimir Ulyanov. I don't think that. I think that Marx was right and Lenin was wrong. Marx wrote to his friends in Germany and said, we cannot cooperate with people who openly state that the workers can only be led to socialism by big or small capitalists.
Somebody, I mean, even you must admit, Harry, as I take the Leninist position, that somebody must lead.
No, I don't agree at all. I think that as long as you have leaders, people will be led up the garden, and that's what afflicts the working man in Canada. There are no leaders. Look, in the I don't know where I am, the Victoria paper. The Victoria paper printed a report of a talk I gave at the university there and said, Socialist Party of Great Britain, Harry Young, the head of the Socialist Party of Great Britain. If I don't write and correct that, when I get back to London, they'll chuck me out. We haven't got any heads, no leaders. Every meeting of our party is open to the public, and every member of that party has got one vote and no more.
Harry Young, I would put you down as a gentle anarchist.
Oh, no, listen, Jack.
In his bed.
No, you're having me on, Jack. Oh, look.
I'm not talking about bombs. I'm talking about a formless society.
In our view, now I'm going to upset some anarchists now. In our view, anarchism is quite futile and idle in organized society. There is no desert island that you can retreat to now where the rest of the world ceases to exist. That's impossible.
Harry Young of the... Merely a member of the Socialist Party.
Absolutely right. A nondescript member.
Six it, but a man in you, Lenin, Trotsky, Bukharin, Zinoviev, and the rest of them. 685-9181. I don't know what we should do now because, you know, we're both...
Ask me to describe the socialist system.
I thought you were trying to do that. Well, try again.
Well, then, all right, Jack. You see, you've said that I'm a utopian dreamer, right?
Right.
Something like that.
Right.
Right. Well, may I quote the words of Ernest Jones, the famous British Chartist of the last century, friend of Karl Marx, and great orator and teacher of the people. He wrote that dreams are but the light of clearer skies, too dazzling for our naked eyes, and when we catch their flashing beams, we turn aside and call them dreams. I tell you, Jack, every thought that yet in sorrow rose, in greatness set, by time to ripening glory nursed, was called an idle dream at first.
Who wrote that?
Ernest Jones.
A Chartist.
A Chartist.
He was a contemporary of Lenin.
No, a contemporary...
Of Marx, Marx.
Marx and Engels.
Of Marx.
A contemporary of Robert Owen and...
Robert Owen was the great enlightened English industrialist.
Yeah, yes, and the founder of cooperative societies and eventually trade unions and came to America and set up a factory here. And was a friend of Frederick Engels, who also was a...
Oh, there have been some good capitalists over the years.
Oh, Frederick Engels was an amazing man. Of anybody who was a dual personality, Frederick Engels was a fox-hunting country squire and a prosperous and wealthy mill owner, friend of Karl Marx and great socialist and socialist scientist.
Would the name Cadbury mean anything in socialist history today?
Well, only to the extent that the Cadburys are liberal reformers.
And they're no good.
Well, only they're just liberals, that's all. I mean, what is the difference between a socialist revolutionary... By the way, revolution doesn't need bloodshed. This is nonsense put out by Trotskyites. We always say in Hyde Park, if you will forgive the expression, bloody revolution is bloody nonsense. The revolution has got to be in people's heads. They've got to think before they can act and vote before they start to march.
When did you last run for Parliament?
In 1951.
How many votes did you get?
Oh, Jack, the first time I ran, I got 250.
And the second time?
253.
And the third time?
No chance.
You lost your deposit.
Well, I'm getting on a bit. Oh, yes. Well, I didn't put the deposit up. I was a teacher. And in those days, teachers were more underpaid than they are now.
You have always, apart from your activities in the Soviet Union for 6 years, you've always worked for a living.
Oh, Christ, I was a teacher for 25 years, mate, right through the mill.
So you have a wee bit of a pension?
Yeah, a teacher's pension, yes.
And what kind of school did you teach at?
What we call secondary modern, but I haven't got time to go into it
now. But what did you teach?
Science. I'm science. I trained as a science teacher in 1948, after the war, when there was a desperate shortage of teachers consequent upon the war.
48, after the last war?
Well,
the second war?
Sure, yeah.
My war?
Yeah.
The good war?
You could say that. We were on the platform in Hyde Park every Sunday denouncing that war.
It had to be a good war.
No, it was not.
How could you
look at the results of it. Is that good?
No, but how could you
What you got as a result of the war was Stalin in Russia.
Well, what would you have done? Would you have let Hitler go?
Not what I would have done. I did do. I refused to go and fight. They said, well, will you drive an ambulance and pick up wounded people in the street? I said, now you're talking.
And you did?
I did for 5 years, mate, through the thick of it.
But what if Hitler hadn't been stopped? We'd all have been automatons today with breeding camps for blue-eyed, fair-haired people.
I know, but if we'd have supported, as the Socialist Party of Great Britain, if we'd have supported Hitler and Franco and Stalin and all these people, we'd be in the same position as the Communist Party is now.
Harry, you're dodging my question.
No, I'm not.
I've asked you a simple question.
I've never dodged a question in my life.
I was a First World War baby, 1918.
All right.
It wasn't before I was 15 or 16 that I knew the First World War was a bad war.
Right.
That was an evil war.
Right.
Despite all the millions who died in it, there was no need for that war.
Right.
The second war, created by the first war, was a different war. Here we had a megalomaniac bent on genocide and created his genocide. Put every Jew he could get his hand on in the gas chambers. Destroyed and ravaged and burned his way across Europe. How could you stand by Harry and not say, this man must be stopped?
Because if you don't stand by your principles and explain socialist principles, then you commit yourself to the war, and once you do that, socialism goes down the drain.
You'd have been the first person in the gas chamber in Britain.
All right, well, I'll go in the gas chamber. I won't go in the gas chamber for murdering workers in another country with whom I've got no quarrel, no, I don't know. If the German workers were stupid enough to follow this idiotic megalomaniac, then that was their funeral. But I'm not going to follow along the same road by following Churchill to do the same sort of thing. Listen. Incidentally, may I say this to you, Jack?
No, I don't want to ask your opinion of Churchill, but I will.
The same, I mean, what you could say, incidentally, how could the First World War have been a good one if it produced the second, a bad one?
Now look,
could the situation in Germany ever have arisen if we hadn't have had the silly communists in Russia building up a communist party in Germany with its Red Front Fighters brigades and leagues, which was the direct instigation of the Hitler Brown? I was in Berlin in 1929.
Harry, I feel I have got you on that one point, that you were prepared to die as a pacifist socialist in the gas chamber and allow this madman Hitler or Goering or Goebbels or any of the rest to dominate the world.
Can I ask you one question?
Yes.
And this is a question I was asked at the tribunal for what's called conscience objectors. That war was supposed to be for democracy, right? Now, could it have been democracy on the part of Great Britain's part if they had suppressed people like me, which, to their credit, they did not? I mean, at least I'll go that far with you, that in Great Britain we did. We were allowed to get up and say this is a capitalist war and we won't support it, and the German working man is an idiot if he follows Hitler.
But the German working man was bludgeoned into following Hitler.
Oh, you can't bludgeon how many? 33 million voted for him.
You can with enough machine guns and torture chambers and gas chambers.
No, when it's 33 million, Jack, you've got the population. Look, I'm the last... Nobody regrets it more than me. I was in Berlin when I've heard Hitler speak. And I was in the Reichstagplatz outside the Parliament building when I looked round and everybody had got their hand up like that.
No, I'll give you the right to be a pacifist, and I admire you to the end for being a pacifist, but you were only able to be a pacifist because the majority of people said we've got to stop Hitler.
I'm going to make you even more angry. I was not a pacifist, and they asked me in the tribunal, would you take up arms to fight for socialism? I said, I don't think you can get socialism by fighting for it, but if you're asking me do I regard human existence or the shedding of blood as a mortal crime or a sanctity of human blood, I'm not a Christian, I don't believe in the immortality of the individual. My socialist objection to the war is solely on economic working class interests. No war under capitalism can ever benefit the working class, and if you don't believe that, Jack, look around you. What good did it do?
Stalin. I can certainly see why they didn't enlist you, because you could have destroyed a brigade.
Right.
Webster and Harry Young, I must give you a chance to talk to them, but I'm enjoying it so much myself, please forgive me. 685-9181. Vancouver at Vancouver Community College. From 12:30 to 2:30, you're going to give them 2 hours. That's a langara.
Mm-hmm.
Some people want to talk to you, Harry. I don't know what they want to talk to you about, but let's take them anyway. Go ahead to Harry Young, and thank you for waiting so patiently and so long.
Hello, is that me?
That's you, ma'am.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Young.
Good morning.
I think you might be interested to know that a close relative of mine, very close relative, was a prominent speaker for the, I think they called it the Socialist Reform Party in the early days, in the 1920s and the early 30s. And the strange thing, well, I don't suppose it's strange, but he was a direct member of the aristocracy.
Well, what was his name, please?
I was going to tell you.
Oh, sorry.
But he had a grudge against them, which was quite genuine, and he then fought and spoke for the workers, and he went under two names, Stonewall Jackson and Jack James. And he was very, very well known. And he...
Do you know him at all, Harry?
Pardon?
Stonewall I can't recall Jackson the name. It's a fairly common name, but I can't... Not Tommy Jackson.
No, I think he spoke for the party under the name of Jack James.
Which party? The Socialist Reform Party?
Mm-hmm.
It's not the same as the Socialist Party of Great Britain.
Oh, yes, this was in London, yes. I thought it was called the Socialist...
No, Party. Sorry, ma'am. Go ahead, please, to Harry Young.
Yes, Mr. Young?
Yes?
I don't know whether you can give me any information on economics, but what do you think of border economics, like devaluing the dollar or the pound?
Harry, she's asking you. Canadian dollar is presently $1.03 to the American dollar. It makes times tough for our exports. Are you concerned on that kind of question?
What?
Are you concerned?
Well, yes, I can answer it.
It's from the monitor.
Well, please, dear lady, don't you know when they write the value of the pound up?
Yeah, what about...
Well, let me explain this to you. We have a platform in Hyde Park called the Socialist Party of Great Britain, and Americans come there and say, what Great Britain? Well, all right, small Britain. Now, all I would say about currency and devaluation and inflation is that it all depends on the number of banknotes you print in proportion to the actual tangible, real material value of the gross national product. If, as they are now doing in England, they're hoping to extricate themselves from the problem by printing more and more bits of paper, promising to pay £1, then, of course, the economy, the financial side of it, will continue to sink. But I do assure you, dear lady, we've been through all this deflation, inflation. In the deflation days, we had the biggest unemployed army we've ever had. So that all that this currency business is, it's the froth on the top of the glass.
Tool of the capitalist. It's a tool of the capitalist.
Oh, yes, yes. Not a very successful one at the moment.
We're running a $6.5 billion deficit in this country, printing money like there's no tomorrow.
Well, Lenin did it to repudiate the Tsar's debts. He said, I'm not going to pay the money back that the Tsar borrowed, so I'm going to keep printing banknotes till they're worthless.
Go ahead, please.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
This is Mr. Turner speaking.
Yes, Mr. Turner.
Just like one question.
Yes.
How old is the gentleman?
75, going on 76.
Thank you very much.
Not a very perceptive call, that. Go ahead, please.
Harry?
Yes?
Did you know Anna Louise Strong?
I met her in Moscow, yes?
Now, what happened to her?
Oh, look, dear lady, you're asking me to write a list of a bit. I wouldn't really know.
She's long dead.
But I she is. Oh, well, Jack can tell you.
You know what she did, don't you?
Remind us.
Well, tell us.
Well, she organized the roving orphans of the revolution.
Oh, yes. Yes, I remember. Yes. The best prisoni in Moscow. Yes. The poor little kids who used to sleep in the tar. You know, they used to spread tar. They had big tar boilers. And these poor little kids used to sleep in them. I do remember. Now you remind me. You've reminded me of my, you know, after this length of time, one's memory fades a bit. But yes, I remember. Now you've reminded me. I remember very well. You've opened up a whole vista for me.
Yes, she was a Seattle clergyman's daughter.
Oh, yes.
From Seattle, Washington. Thank you. Go ahead, please.
Harry?
Yes?
I don't know whether it was Engels or Marx, but how do you think it applies today, whichever one said of the thesis on the destructive impact of the capitalistic system on the laboring classes and the thesis of the alienation of labor under capitalism?
Well, I would agree with the alienation theory, but you see, one thing I don't agree with, and about which there appears to be a tremendous lot of confusion, that is, I'm being a bit presumptuous here, of course. I'm a Democrat. I'm only offering my opinion. I'm chucking my hat in the ring alongside everybody else's. But my view, my reading of Marx never propounded this so-called theory of increasing misery. It's not true that it's that section of the working class which is the most oppressed, the most deprived, that they're starving without shoes to their feet like Oliver Twist, and therefore they become revolutionary and blow everything up. On the contrary, I think that the greatest socialist progress will come from the most prosperous and affluent working class in the United States and Canada, because before people can acquire education, they've got to have a reasonable modicum of subsistence.
But they're bought off by the affluence of the capitalist class.
I know, but listen, Jack, that's not going to last forever. If one thing is absolutely certain, it is that human society, like everything else, and here I'm quoting from Marx, quoting from Hegel, the philosopher, everything is subject to a process of constant change and evolution. As Marx wrote in the Communist Manifesto, everything that previously appeared stable crumbles.
Is it not a fact, Harry Young, that the advent of television, the medium is the message, is the one factor which has wiped out the acceptance of inequality throughout the world, and that eventually, instead of coming to your socialism by education and tolerance and understanding, that we'll finish up with great massive state bureaucracies attempting to keep everybody happy on an egalitarian level?
Ah, well, now we're coming back to whether Marx was right when he said capitalism trains the working class and educates it. Now, I say that it does. And sitting right in front of you, old Johnny, is a tangible example. I was trained to be a science teacher by the capitalist class. Who else?
And you were an enemy of the capitalist class.
That's right. Well, they can't help that. Well, look, they taught me how to teach science. They taught me physics, right, and a bit of chemistry and biology, which I've taught very successfully, I may say. I'll show you references which I couldn't have written better myself than the Institute of Education. And I never attempted at any time as a democratic socialist to indoctrinate children. What I would do is put all the points of view that I knew before a kid and say, look, son, when you grow older, you'll have to think for yourself. And if they do, then they will become an educated working class. There is no barrier to scientific knowledge. No computer or electronic device has yet been established by the capitalists to prevent knowledge spreading among the workers.
Do you know what I think about you, Harry Young?
Yes. I'm an old goat.
No, I certainly do not. But I think that environment is a thing. You came from a working class background. You used to listen to the Communist Party orators. You went off to become the national organizer of the youth movement.
Right.
If you had somehow or other got in a corner of the street with a tambourine flashing and Evangeline Booth there, you could have been one of the great evangelists for the Salvation Army. And I say that because you are a man with an evangelical spirit.
Well, all right, but my evangelical spirit only comes from what I consider to be my scientifically proved knowledge.
I'll back away from that one. 6859181. Young.
Yeah. Yes, most of the Marxists I've spoken to say that violence is absolutely necessary to bring about the change in society, and they point to countries like Cuba and China. I'd like your comments on this.
These people are not Marxists. Some of them quite intentionally defraud the people they talk to. Others are, I'm sorry to say, and of course we have plenty of them in Britain, where I come from. We have a so-called international Marxist group whose main tenet is organized individual physical violence. Now, may I inform you, dear young lady, that Karl Marx was a most vehement and consistent opponent of terrorism in any shape or form. In 1950 in France, when they were all exiled there to the new French Republic, there were a number of these hotheads and lunatics who wanted to organize marches back onto German territory to restart the civil war there. Marx denounced these people and told them it would take them 50 years before their mentality changed to the point where they would be capable of making a constitutional legal change. But there's another aspect of this. I'm going to surprise you as a Marxist now. I don't care whether Marx said it or didn't say it, and I don't care whether he lived or never lived, but what is absolutely certain is that socialism can't be established until a majority of the people consciously, intelligently, and knowingly want it and are determined to work hard voluntarily to maintain it. Therefore, you've got to have a majority, and every attempt that's been made by minorities up to the time of speaking, from the Paris Commune onwards, has always ended in a fantastic, hopeless disaster. No leaders can lead the workers to socialism. It's got to be done, as Marx said on more than one occasion, by the workers themselves. I'm sorry, these people are not Marxists. They are frauds.
But they say that even though you have the majority of the workers, the people at the top will not relinquish their power. And so the use of violence becomes necessary.
Well, I don't know how they know all this about the people at the top, because the people at the top don't know themselves anyway. But we know this old chestnut about the resistance of the capitalist class. But don't you see that? What you're overlooking, we're in 1976 today. Not 1840 or 1870. Today, this is exactly the process that Marx predicted has taken place before our eyes. We've got the overwhelming preponderance, the immense majority. In Britain at the present time, we've got more than 10 to 1 are members of the working class. Not only are they members of the working class, but they do everything. If they stop working, you'd notice. But if the capitalist class all faded tonight, you wouldn't. Now, therefore, once the working class decides, I was explaining to Jack here, in my view, it's like the glacier on Mount Baker. Once it starts to move, nothing can stop it. And you don't require insurrections by minorities to instigate it.
When you get back on your soapbox at Hyde Park and you think for a moment about Canada, in 1 minute or less, what will you tell them in Hyde Park about your trip?
I will tell them, and this is no soft soap, Jack. I mean, you know me, I'm not trying to flannel anybody. Undoubtedly, I've been speaking on the radio all over the Canadian continent. And by the way, Canada is too bloody big. You've got to make it smaller. I can't do it. I'm living on Greyhound buses. Is that the affluent society? And living on hamburgers. So that, and by the way, I paid my own fare when they asked me who sent me here. I paid my own fare by doing broadcasts, teaching private lessons and writing articles. I got one in the Sunday Observer, Lenin's last speech. But what I'm going to say is the most enjoyable time, and I mean this, Jack. I mean it from my heart. The best time I've had in Canada is with Jack Webster.
My thanks to Harry Young, the peaceful, true, socialist, non-violent revolutionary. Hear him at Langara, Thursday at 12:30. Next to news.